You may remember that all the women from Hastinapura, the capital of the Kauravas, had been led down to the battleground, and the battleground really was now a burial ground. There was constant weeping and wailing and grief and sadness. And the pyres that were put together were burning all along the banks of the Ganges. And the Pandavas themselves, remember, they were about to make the last oblations and perform the last rites when Kunti revealed to them that would they actually include Karna, because there's no one else to perform these last rites, and Karna was their eldest brother. It was an enormous shock to Yudhishthira. It really was a hammer blow to him. The grief and sorrow for Karna's death was far more so for him than the death of Abhimanyu, Arjuna's son, by Krishna's sister, and the actual death of his own sons, their family's own sons, the Draupadis. So they entered the waters of the Ganges, and they asked for the women folk, Karna's women folk, to join them. Two wives of Vrishali and Supriya. And Supriya actually was very friendly with Banamati. Banamati was the wife of Duryodhana, and they joined them in the waters. And after they come out of the waters, it was then that Narayana related the story that we all know of how, in fact, Karna was the son of the sun god, as well as being the firstborn of Kunti. Yudhishthira, as was the custom in these situations, had exiled all the brothers for a month from going back and sorting out the administration of the Kuru nation and Hastinapura. They were in exile for a month, and he arranged accommodation all around the banks of the Ganges there. And very quickly, he fell into depression. He just couldn't get over how he was responsible for the enormous death of the not only the warriors, but actually of the suffering of their families. Mother Kunti had said to Yudhishthira that she and Surya came at the same time. The father came when Kunti told Karna that she was his mother. The banks of the Ganges just before the wither, just before the battle, when he was there praying his early oblations that went right on to noon. And while she was waiting for him to finish those, remember, actually Surya came as well, and they both said, don't fight, don't do this war, and if you do, join the Pandavas, join the righteousness of your brothers. But this had no effect upon Yudhishthira. In fact, one evening, where his depression was deepening all the time, they sat round together, and the holy fires, were still flickering, and the Brahmins, the Rishis, were pottering around with putting oblations and chanting around them. And he announced that he wasn't going to be king. He was going to renounce the throne in favour of Arjuna. Arjuna could do it with the help and advice, perhaps, of Krishna. And he railed, he criticised like anything, the Kshatriya caste, how that it had produced so much suffering, so much death of people in their prime. He wanted to retire to the forest and spend the rest of his life in asceticism. In actual fact, he talked about not only living the life of a renunciant, but actually minimizing his food until, in fact, he would be living on air to purify his being so that he could be, when he died, at one with the Lord Supreme. In actual fact, it was this that happened to Vidura sometime ahead. He had actually also taken that path to eternity. For so many parents, for so many sons that had been lost, he blamed Duryodhana and he blamed Dhritarashtra. Well, the brothers looked at themselves, and Arjuna pretty quickly answered, saying, and he's looking at Krishna at the same time, he said to him that it's the duty of Yudhishthira as a king to protect his people, and that poverty was for those who wanted to go into the forests, or for the rishis and so on, but for kings, wealth was the important thing, for the people, for charity to the people, and particularly so for the major sacrifices that a king should perform, or he should organize, for the benefit of the gods and thus the benefit of his people. And in turn, each of the brothers had to go at him, actually including Draupadi, with a dichotomy of the benefits of an ascetic's life and the benefits of a king's life, the duty of a king's life, and what that duty should do and how it should be performed. Yudhishthira didn't accept Arjuna's point, and Bhima then chimed in, and he was getting pretty impatient with his attitude, that is, of centering the life of a king and the duties of a king, and taking on what he looked upon as an idle life. And he said that if we'd known this, then what on earth would be the point of killing all their brothers? They often refer to Duryodhana as brothers and cousins. And he pointed out pretty clearly that in fact a king's duty is to kill his enemies so that he is able to lead a righteous life. And that in fact this was ordained by the Supreme Being, the Lord Supreme. And he said that renunciation actually is for the old men or people who've been conquered. But Yudhishthira remained silent. And then Arjuna piped in again and pointed out that in fact life of a householder, if it's done with detachment from worldliness, then that's the surest path to righteousness. Nakula joined in, and his point was that real renunciation was an internal thing, not external. And doing one's duty should be done in a way of detachment if it is going to be a true renunciation. And actually, Sahadeva said the same sort of thing, that in fact, everything should be done with detachment. Then one would have the virtue that in fact Yudhishthira was seeking. And in fact, Draupadi, she had a bit to say too, and she's very sweet really, because you know, Draupadi could be pretty feisty, but she spoke in a very soothing way. She pointed out that in the forest, Yudhishthira had said to them all, when their morale was low and things like that, that very soon they would slay Duryodhana and they would come back to their kingdom. So she exhorted him to take up his scepter, to give to charity, to subdue his enemies, give worship to the gods with sacrifices, so that in fact the whole family and the brothers could be happy. But Yudhishthira was unmoved. He sat there looking at the ground. He picked up the ground in his hand, a handful of dust, and let it float it through. And it was only really when Vyasa, the sage Vyasa, started talking that he, out of respect to him, started to take some note of what was being said. He said that Yudhishthira should maintain his dharma. There should be no renunciation. And in actual fact, he pointed out that all that happened had been fated. It had happened by fate. And he also pointed out that Yudhishthira was purely an instrument of fate, and that he should perform the horse sacrifice. We have talked about that, and we'll certainly have a look at that in more detail. Krishna came over, he put his arm round Yudhishthira and said, "This you must do, you must follow what Vyasa says." And at last he started to come round, he got up, and was really, you know, having been slumped down on his seat, he got up and he started to change his mind. And the other thing that actually triggered this reversal in him was the fact that he began to ask what he should do as a king, how he should actually rule. And it was then that Vyasa said, well, Bhishma is still alive, and soon he will be into the next world in his own time, and therefore he should be consulted before that happened, because he was unique in the knowledge he had about kingsmanship. So at the end of the month, they all gathered together, preparing to go back to Hastinapura. It was, in fact, quite a slow procession, because Yudhishthira put Dhritarashtra and his wife, Gandhari, as a couple, right at the front of the procession that was going to go back to the city. Behind him came his chariot and 16 bullocks, a white chariot, and it had deer skins over the terraces of it. Yudhishthira sat there, Bhima took the reins, behind him, holding an umbrella over him, was Arjuna, and the twins, Nakula Sahadeva, either side fanning him as he went along. And behind him was Krishna and Satyaki, and Krishna had his own driver, Daruka, it was his own chariot, and behind them was a whole elephants and chariots. And as they came towards Hastinapura, some way off, they could hear the drums and the conches and the cheerings. It was just like, in fact, when Krishna came for his negotiations. All the streets had been cleaned. There were garlands everywhere. People were cheering to them as they came up. And in the large houses on the terraces, there were women throwing down jewels and cheering and throwing down actually little pieces of silk. And actually Draupadi went by, and she had a sort of white canopy over her chariot, and all the women were cheering at her, and they said, really, how fortunate you are. You must have done many good things to be so fortunate as you are to have the husbands and coming back into the city. It was a very joyous affair. And so they went towards the palace, the wide gates of the palace, and there they halted. Inside, there were the sacred chants from the Brahmins, and they were led in and sat on a beautiful gold chair. Draupadi sat next to Yudhishthira. The holy fire was in front of them. The others sat round, and then various things were thrown into the fire, ghee and honey and yogurt and a lot of chanting. And the whole ceremony was finalized when Krishna, with a great big white conch, poured water over the head of Yudhishthira. Yudhishthira gave lots of charity out to the Brahmins and so forth, and he said how he didn't feel worthy of all the words that had been said to him. And one thing he did say, he was quite emphatic, that in fact Dhritarashtra was their father, he should be obeyed, anything he wanted should be given to him, and that he shouldn't be treated anyway differently than he was before the battle. Well, if you have been, thanks very much for listening.